request from Representative Ulmer to make a comment or two.
Just very quickly, I promise to make it quick because I do have to go. As someone who has not had the benefit of hearing all of the discussion, this is probably a very risky thing to do. But having had some familiarity with the issue before today and also what I heard this morning, I would just like to suggest that at some point it might be useful for this group to try to reach consensus on what the basic problems are. I mean, like, come up with a short list of the problem is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then, as David has done a lot of research and we have various bills and other ideas sort of roaming around, that you could match a problem number one, with a set of possible solutions that address that problem. And then problem number two, and then there are a number of bills and other concepts out there that maybe address that particular problem. And then at the end of this deliberative process, at some point, whenever this doesn't exist anymore, that you would actually have a document that would say, this task force agreed that the problems that needed to be addressed were 1 through 6, and the range of solutions that address each of those problems are as follows. And it would be sort of a logical way of bringing some focus to a very, very complicated and obviously somewhat emotional issue. And I'd like to sort of throw out on my way out the door 6 problem statements.
And sure, just throw them right out.
They're real general and they're probably not the full range here, but number one, the escalating cost of insurance and healthcare. And obviously, under escalating cost of insurance and healthcare, which impacts everyone, every single one of us, you know, there are possibilities under that general problem statement, including regulating insurance companies, subsidizing insurance, reducing cost, risk, or exposure, a change in the medical delivery system. So you have that problem, and there are a range of solutions. Number two, shortage of medical care in Alaska in certain areas, that is geographically, and in certain specialties. So this problem of a shortage of medical care, which again impacts many people, but different people differently depending upon where they live and whether or not they happen to be delivering a baby or whatever their problem is, the shortage of medical care could be addressed by, again under the general problem solution possibilities, the state can spend money to buy care for certain types of people, or can subsidize the insurance for those physicians offering that care in that area or that specialty, either indirectly or directly. Third problem statement. This is probably a better way of saying it, but uncertainty for professionals. The sort of problem emotionally, professionally, financially associated with that big risk, that big exposure out there. And that is a problem that I think, although not as visible as the others, is significant, both with regard to the reduction of professionals who are willing to practice in the field, and the way in which they feel about the job they're doing, and perhaps as a result, the quality that they actually give. So that uncertainty for professionals, what are the possible solutions to that? I don't know, peer review panels, some systemization of standard of care, I don't know. Number four, fair compensation for injured parties. That issue was raised this morning. What about the injured people who end up suing but don't end up with anything? What about some sort of safety net for injured persons in our society? That's a significant problem, both under the current system and under most other systems that I can think of, but it's important. That is fair compensation for injured parties. What are the solutions to that? I don't know, a no-fault system, a guaranteed level of care, a new medical delivery system, a schedule of benefits, more mediation or arbitration. I don't know, but fair compensation to injured. Number five, greed. This is, again, there's probably a more artful way of saying this, but greed, and that is the high expectations of individuals to make it big. They're looking for the big hit. And that's sort of a societal problem here, I think, that goes far beyond the issue that's being discussed by this group. But it's this feeling that, well, gee, everybody wants to win a lottery. And should this system of fairly compensating individuals and making sure that somebody gets care really carry over into this notion that I can really make a bundle? And somehow needing to maybe segregate or separate or reorient people into thinking, yes, this system should compensate me for being injured, but it shouldn't be the ticket to heaven, right? And what are the solutions to that? Well, maybe any punitive money, quote unquote, that is money that a litigant receives in addition, above what they need to really deal with their problem, shouldn't go to that individual litigant, but rather to the state of Alaska, to an insurance pool, to MICA, to somebody other than just that litigant. So they get compensated for all of their lost wages, their et cetera, but anything above that, the big hit phenomenon, doesn't go to the individual litigant. It goes to the system as a whole to somehow reduce the cost of medicine or reduce the cost of insurance or something. So it takes away the greed aspect. And then finally, number six, the cost of the decision making under the current system. Now this one maybe is just a subset of number one, the escalating cost of insurance and healthcare, or maybe not. And different people, depending upon the role you play in the existing system, may view that differently. But I think there's generally perceived that there's a problem in how much of the GNP associated with medical care and professional care and insurance goes into how the system just plain works. And that's generalized feelings that, gee, the attorneys get too much, or gee, the court system, maybe experts get too much, or that there are certain inefficiencies with the distribution of benefits to injured parties under the current system that perhaps could somehow be helped. And again, whether that's simplifying the process somehow, including binding mediation or arbitration, or somehow addressing some of the specifics of the tort system that people really feel speak to the cost of the system. So there are six problem statements. Obviously, there can be a fair amount of debate about whether those are the right six or the wrong six or how to change the statement. But as I leave you, I would just like to suggest, respectfully suggest, that one thing that might be worthwhile for this group to be to kind of target on: what are the problems? Which of the proposed bills and possible solutions really would reduce the problems? And then maybe there'd be a consensus on some, if not all, of the things that should be done by this legislature. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to do that.
Thank you. Mark.
Thank you, David. Fran, I appreciate your comments, but I just want to remind us that there are other groups than just the healthcare providers that are part of this overall challenge, and I don't think you meant to slight the others, but I think that as we develop these statements that we should probably also keep that in mind. I think your six statements very fairly represent some of the issues that we're talking about.
What I'd like to do, if there are no other comments on Fran's comments, is turn it back to Ginger, and it's 3:10. People have got to catch airplanes, so we need to get out of here probably about 5. So I'd like to get this part of the discussion wrapped up pretty quick so that we can spend some time talking about the big picture before everybody has to run off.
Very quickly, House Bill 355 is the next bill up. We have a House Chamber of Commerce committee substitute. The VA imposes a uniform premium tax. The premium tax is about $25 million a year. The state of Alaska is the fourth largest source of revenue. All premium tax goes to the general fund. None of it is used for regulation of the insurance industry. There are 8 different types of insurance, levels of insurance charged, and it was very confusing and difficult for the division to monitor. This just means everybody pays the same, the exception being that healthcare service corporations, Blue Cross, et cetera, will remain at their lower rate of premium tax. We did not bring them up to the 2.7%. It would have added about $2 million a year to healthcare insurance, and consumers pay for it one way or the other, and it was just easier to not up it. Everybody else is going to pay a uniform tax. The other key part about the bill is that it specifically exempts MICA from the premium tax. You all know, I'm sure, that MICA is in a discussion with the IRS about their tax status. The fact that the state of Alaska was charging its own corporation a premium tax cast some doubt on that tax status, so we don't charge it in this bill.
If you get a chance, would you ask the director to make sure that Blue Cross is not charging the policyholders anyway?
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay, next, House Bill.
Questions? Yes,
Dr. In one of the handouts that you gave us, I thought that I read, and I could be wrong about this, I thought that I read the tax, premium tax on health insurance, I'm not saying it right, health liability insurance companies was 6%.
It's 0.6% of the gross of something. I'm sorry, I should have my file on it. It was the healthcare service corporations is the buzzword, and they pay a premium tax, but the 2.7%, which is a standard tax, is based on
property casualty premium.
Yes, thank you. And the healthcare corporations pay a different percent of a different amount. I'm sorry I can't be clear to that. They actually pay significantly lower premium tax than the standard. They do not pay 6%. They don't pay 6% of the same percent that everybody else is paying 2.7% of. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, next.
I must have been, I sit on that committee, and I think I must have been asleep at the switch. Why did we exempt Blue Cross and Aetna?
I'm not sure that Aetna is under this category, Representative Grunberg. I know the one that did come to mind was Blue Cross. The reason why, these are non-profit health insurance providers. They don't provide malpractice insurance, they provide health insurance. And they are not, this particular one is a non-profit agency. And if we charge them, if we up their premium tax, which would increase their premium tax by about $2 million a year, it would just be passed directly on to the consumer, and the consumer is going to be paying that. That didn't seem to be a logical system. Also, the purpose of 355 was to streamline the premium tax so the Division of Insurance would be able to effectively collect the premium tax that was due to the state. They didn't have any confusion on the premium tax that was due from the Healthcare Service Corporation. They had considerable confusion over the wet marine and self-procured insurance. That was the primary fix here. We didn't have a problem with Healthcare Corporation.
Where is the Blue Cross exemption?
It's not here. I mean, it's not, in other words, it doesn't need to be mentioned here, because all this bill does is each place where we're changing somebody's insurance, it's brought up in this bill and said it goes from this to this.
I see, so something had to have been added.
Yes, and there was something added indirectly in the original bill, and that was taken out in the community substitute.
So Blue Cross was in the original bill?
Well, all healthcare service corporations were in the
original bill. Where is that in the original bill?
I'm trying to find it. It may not be something that's going to be readily apparent because it's going to be quoted by a statute, but then I don't know what that means. Healthcare service.
I guess I should say to the group that I have some difficulty completely leading them out. I certainly like to understand it better.
I will bring to the task force, if you would like, a copy of the position paper from the Division of Insurance as to the arguments about whether or not we should have included healthcare service corporations, the reason that we took it down. Another thing, there was obviously a political concern, not the least of which is that the committee's intent was not to raise money through this bill. Even without the raise in healthcare service corporations, it still raises about, I think, $170,000. We didn't intend to do that. We wanted to make it uniform so that it will free up a great deal of the Division of Insurance's time and staff because of the ease of collecting this uniform tax as opposed to the complex one that we have. Unfortunately, one of the side effects is that there was an increase, a tax increase, if you will, which was not the intent of the committee. We even considered reducing the overall tax to 2.6 from 2.7 so that there would not be an increase because we didn't want it to look at as a revenue measure.
Okay.
House Bill 355. House Bill 429, I don't know if this task force wants to get into it. This is very specific to auto insurance and subrogation of claims, and it's incredibly complex.
Next slide, hold on.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, if you don't want to get into that one.
434 is a measure that is a revolving door measure. It was suggested by Robert Hunter in the How to Tame the Insurance Crisis. It started out as a bill that simply said the Division of Insurance Director cannot own any stock in an insurance company before, during, or after, for a year before, during the time they serve as insurance director, and for a year after. It was trying to close that revolving door. It then grew into a committee substitute that involved all sorts of state employees, and the committee finally decided last week that they were going to tear the bill back down to just the insurance director, and that should come out next month. Next Tuesday we'll be taking that up.
Okay.
Senate Bill 268, next to the stack, is the Senate vehicle of the Joint Service Bill that we talked about earlier, passed into law last year. Senate Bill 323 is the duplicate of the Governor's Compensation Fund. Senate Bill 451 is, in essence, a duplication of House Bill 166. That's it. In my stack.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Peter.
I guess we're done with the bills.
Sorry.
We haven't hit 166. One more bill. 166. Can I ask a question? It's a kind of long question. It's very short. I just was wondering on the rates of litigation on statute cases. Is there
correlation with the age of the mother? I mean, we got a teen pregnancy problem in this state. I just wanted to know if there was a specific relationship to anyone knew about. Thanks, Brian.
Okay, I'm going to go real fast through 166. House Bill 166 came into Labor Commerce Committee last year. We have
just before you get started, this one, this group's already discussed it once, I think. Although there's probably some points that are going to, you know, McGuire and Jefferson and several people are going to want to make comments on some of the separate things in here, like statute of repose, like a few other things. So probably let's expect that, but let's really try to not say the same thing over and over again, and everybody kind of think about how they're going to make their points on this, so we don't spend 2 hours.
And we've already done Rule 82, so that's not on the list.
What Ginger can do is she walks us through, when you hit the different points, you can say how it was originally introduced and how the issue was treated in the conversation. Once Ginger gets through with that, then let everybody kind of get a couple shots off, and I think we'll get through it that way. Does that sound fair to everybody?
Yeah. As long as there aren't shots of Ginger.
The House Labor and Commerce Committee made some changes in the findings. There were some things in the findings that we felt were not substantiated enough to put in the findings. I want to warn you that in virtually every other bill, we've taken the findings out, all findings and purposes. We don't like those in our committee, so the fact that they stayed in at all is something. On page 2 of the House Labor and Commerce Committee substitute, starting with line 2, paragraph E, through the rest of section 1, that's all new language to this committee substitute, and sections 2 through 5 are based on California statute of repose and limitations. Now, we all know the difference between the statute of repose and the statute of limitations. That was a great deal of controversy in our committee. House Bill 166 is introduced. I think that is a 6-year statute of repose.
And was a general statute of repose that covered all actions.
It covered everything. And the section 2 through 5 are based on, now that's not, they're not identical to California law. They're based on California law. The statute of repose that we decided on after exempting things like pipelines and other things that transport hazardous waste, or hazardous materials, we settled for a 15-year statute of repose
on
this
construction CS. Actions.
On construction.
Construction-related.
Yes, we exempted altogether product liability. Because that...
and I agreed with that.
Yeah, right. We don't produce enough products to last to be worried about
that. But what section are you reading from?
I'm looking at the labor and commerce...
Yeah, we need to look at the CS. Yeah, I think I got that. 166. Go to page 2, bottom 2, section 2, all the way through page 4.
Oh, I see.
There are two statutes of repose here. One is a construction claim statute of repose that Ginger just talked about for 15 years, and then there's an additional one for medical malpractice actions, which I think that one is probably the closest to the California statute.
And that's 910.070 is the...
That's the 910.055 is the first one, and the next one is 910.065, which is on page 3, section 5. That's the medical mal.
I threw that one off at the beginning. Page 2, when I said started to quote, that was just new findings that the committee added. The meat of it starts with section 2.
Right. And there, as I recall, there are two. The original bill had a general statute of repose that covered all actions. The Labor and Commerce Committee narrowed the scope of it and created essentially two statutes of repose, one for construction-related actions of 15 years, and then this medical mal statute of repose.
And we want to say that the statute of repose of 15 years is the longest. Florida is the only state that has it. I mean, we had a range, from 15 to 2, 15 to 3 years to pick from. The committee was very uncomfortable. The majority of the committee was very uncomfortable with the statute of repose because it just says you can't sue no matter what. And that was, they were uncomfortable with that. They came up with the longest, which is better than what we have now, which is nothing, but...
Right, the old one that Jefferson got thrown out, it was 6 years, as I recall.
Do you want comments now on this, or are you going to just go through?
I'd say jump in.
Okay, I was going to say, I just got I got this from AIA, National AIA, this is American Institute of Architects. They have a governmental affairs department in Washington, D.C., and this report basically says that a 1987 study revealed that all claimants who received indemnity payments were injured within 11 years of the completion of construction, 95% within 9 years. And so I'm not sure what the basis of the 15 is. That's probably excessive, and it basically adds 4 more years that were open to lawsuits which cost lots of money when there's a zero chance of getting a payment by the claimant. So I would argue that I attended a lot of those hearings, and there was a strong argument that there was no reason whatsoever for statute of repose, and so they picked the longest period. In fact, 45 states in the District of Columbia currently have something in statute of repose, so we're one of the a few remnant states that do not.
In a nutshell, could you tell us what your your group's concern is with this whole issue? I mean, the primary.
Basically, there needs to be an effort to balance the rights of victims in getting payments for injuries, and also architects being able to sort out their affairs.
And the problem is for you.
Well, our buildings last, you know, for decades. Our office has buildings that are still standing that are 50 years old, and once the substantial completion occurs, and then something happens, we're basically finished with the project. We have no control normally under maintenance of the project, additions, changes. At some point, it becomes excessively likely that it's a maintenance problem rather than a design problem. And also, the records that we have to keep and the number of parties that are involved in a construction project make it increasingly difficult to sort out the problem as years go by. I'm not even sure how you would do it 15 years out. So there's sort of a practicality issue there, too.
Do you have the same situation as the doctors? Does your insurance coverage today have to cover you for what you did 15 years ago, or does your insurance coverage of 15 years ago have to cover you for future?
Our insurance today has to cover it, cover everything that we've done. As a matter of fact, that's a problem, too. I've talked to several architects in the state who, for whatever reason, have lost coverage for a year. And it basically means they've lost coverage for all past projects. Okay. You have to maintain your insurance constantly.
Isn't there an argument? I think I remember this argument come up last year that just might at least make cost of tail coverage less expensive.
It probably would, although I can't say that.
Yeah,
for sure.
I've heard it. I just never looked at it.
I think I can't tell you for sure that this will lower our insurance rates, but I'm mainly interested in reducing claims that occur so far out. We've had a couple of claims that have led to nothing and cost thousands of dollars.
So this isn't as much an insurance rate issue as just a general concern about
doing business under these circumstances.
I would appreciate anything that the task force develops on that particular question, because me, when I'm driving my car, if I have an accident, I'm liable, or my insurance company is covering me for the accident I have while I'm driving, but it seems that the doctors and the architects are buying insurance for things that have nothing to do with the carrier that carries them today, that in my view, which is probably naive, should be covered by the person who insured them at the time that they were generating that liability. And I think it is especially destructive to the professions, because it essentially means that a person with no experience can have much less liability and consequently, I would assume, pay less for insurance than a person who's a seasoned professional. Absolutely. It just seems totally insane to me.
That's exactly what happens. I have a friend who's a new architect, and he pays less than $1,000 per year prenup because he has no projects in his past.
This is something I'd appreciate any knowledge that you can develop for me to evaluate in terms of language of statute, because it just defies common sense, and maybe there's some reason for it, but I should have heard it yet.
Max and then Jeffrey.
Just two things. You mentioned the statistics there, X percent after so many years, et cetera. Would it be possible for you to have maybe somebody else would like to see that, if Jeff could copy that, so at least I could get a copy of that?
I have two copies. I could give you this book.
Oh, okay. Does it also say in there, you said 45 states have something over?
Yeah, actually the wording is that 45 states either have a statute of repose or statute that has been interpreted as such. And this compendium has every existing state's law in it.
I would be very interested, and we'll use that for the House Judiciary.
Okay, well, who do I give this to? Just pass it down.
Yeah, you can send that over to Max. Yeah,
pass it down.
Thank
you very much. Okay.
Jeffrey, sorry.
I just wanted, at the last time we met, I was under the impression, I think it was someone from Mike or someone from the insurance division, and it was in relationship to Representative Gall's question, ask about the difference between claims made and occurrence. And as I understood the situation, the cost of the, you know, you can get this other insurance for lawyers, doctors, and architects and engineers. We all have the same type of coverage. But the premium, if you're going to go to the occurrence premium, which is what the automobile is, you basically are going to pay more for, you know, the same cost of buying the tail, if divided and spread out over the number of years that the tail is intended to cover, the same insurance could be bought by adding that additional premium on an annual basis to get occurrence coverage. In other words, the cost is really the same.
I heard that too.
That was what the testimony was.
Yeah.
I can give you some insight into how that works, at least in my experience with Micah. And I think what Jeff has said is essentially correct. In setting a rate to start with, you start as if you were going to sell a current form insurance, that is, insurance which would cover everything that might happen to the insured during that particular policy period. But because because in our business at least, there's a fairly predictable time within which the occurrences actually turn into claims, instead of charging the insured for all of the claims that may eventually come out based on a particular year's activity, you charge them the first year only for the occurrences that are likely to result in claims that year. The second year, that insured is paying for not only a comparable coverage to what he paid for the first year, but also the claims that are likely to have to eventuate from actions that occurred in the first year.
So the price keeps going up.
The price goes up until year five. In year five, that's considered a mature rate because almost everything that is going to happen to become a claim has surfaced by that time.
Can I interrupt you there and ask, if I understand you correctly, are you saying that, let me rephrase, there's been a lot of discussion about the statute of limitations with regard to minors. Are you saying that the rates that are in existence are based on a five-year period irrespective of that lack of statute of limitations?
That's true, and I think that because of the fact that you're right, there is always a theoretical exposure out there for 19, 20, 21 years, depending on how you interpret it. We do recognize an ongoing exposure, but the present value of that exposure is small enough that it isn't practical to try to factor that into the rate scheme. But if I might just finish, then the idea of a tail is one that people don't understand. They say, gosh, you're paying again for insurance that you already paid for. But what it amounts to is that in the year that you stop practice, let's say, you still have the 4 years of expected reported claims on the last year you practiced, 3 years on the next to last year, 2 years on the third from the last year, and so forth. So that basically that is the catch-up. So that when you get, if you buy a tail when you discontinue coverage, then you are paying, at least in theory, you have paid for the same amount of coverage that you would have if you had bought occurrence form of coverage every year during that period that you were covered by the same carrier.
And in your last year of practicing medicine, and presumably your last year of buying insurance, after that point, are you now uncovered, or do you have that five-year protection, so to speak?
There are two answers to that in our system. One is, for a physician, for example, who has been covered for a certain number of years, and it depends on age, and retires or is disabled or dies, we have built into our premium structure an automatic extended reporting endorsement, which is the tail. In other words, the premium structure provides that they have what we call a free tail cover for that period of time. For if they've been in the program for that period of time, that is spelled out in the contract. For someone who leaves the state, for example, and or otherwise continues in practice but drops their insurance, they can buy the tail coverage, which then essentially converts their prior coverage to occurrence form.
It gives them 5 years forward or indefinitely.
My recollection is that it's indefinite, but I wouldn't want to quote that. Maybe Russell.
Well, I was just thinking that by the way, it's 7 years continuous coverage under MICA, but it just simply goes back. I'm not sure.
I'm just saying that if the standard situation is that your insurance today covers you for past failures, when you cease to buy insurance, when you cease to practice medicine, if those are simultaneous, are you now uncovered, or do you have an extended period for claims based on your previous
coverage?
If you
pay the tail coverage, which I think Mike is right now, is about 1.5 times your annual premium. In one case, $90,000 the doctor had come up with at this point.
I understand, but I'm not asking for the price, but I'm just saying, you're saying that yes, you can get that extended coverage for an additional cost.
Yes.
If you don't pay that additional cost,
you don't,
when you stop practicing and stop insuring yourself, all of your prior work suddenly becomes uncovered.
Exactly.
Unless it's under one of these provisions for retirement, disability, or death, which
doesn't make sense to me.
Okay.
I appreciate what you're saying financially.
Could I ask a question? No, in your opinion, those years of exposure. Do you have any thoughts about why the insurance companies all dictated to us that we would have claims made here?
I'd ask Kyle, and none of them will answer.
I think I have an answer, but I don't know if I'm right or not.
Well, I can give you an answer, and actually it has two parts. One is they're probably both obvious. One is that because of the changes in the way laws are interpreted and in the way liability is determined by the court, over time, the fact that we charge the premium based upon current experience every year rather than on what circumstances might have been 10 years ago when that person first bought an insurance policy allows the insurance company to protect itself again to some extent against those adverse developments in court interpretations and in statutes that might, in essence, make us liable for a greater risk than we had insured against. The second thing is, and this is related to that it is not possible by reinsurance for on anything but a claims made basis.
That's the answer I've got.
Well, it's that's because it's true.
I mean, that's the only answer I've got, is that they won't sell us reinsurance. And then when I try to take it to the next level, I get nothing.
Mr. Speaker, I just would like to say, because it's the first tort reform concept that I really am anxious personally to get a clear understanding of, and maybe you've got resources to do it. It seems to me that I need to understand why changes in the law should not be prohibited from impacting current insurance. Just as you were saying, if people are worried the law is going to change, so they don't know what they're exposing themselves to. To me, that's sort of an ex post facto kind of situation. It seems to me, if you buy insurance, if you operate under the law today, and you're worried about a claim showing up against your legitimate insurance, your legitimate operations today, that would be altered by some legal change in the future. I very much like to know the arguments against protecting the insured and the insurance companies from additional exposure over time. Because right in here, I'm not expert enough to smell the money, but there's something here that should save people money if you could predict the terms under which your risk could be assessed for the future. Under current law, expect that to remain forward based on claims made against malfeasance today. And I think there's something there. I don't understand it, but maybe your folks will be able to help me too. And I just want to put it down because the concerns would be great.
Well, there's been, in the last 10 years, we've had a lot of tort reform, and I'm wondering, are you aware of any instances where people have had money returned to them who paid the higher price for the tail, and since then they've had tort reform so that the exposure to the insurance company is less now than it was when they bought the tail? Were any of that money returned to people?
So far, we've seen no evidence that the exposure has been reduced.
By the tort reform, I see.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Dr. McGuire, and then move on.
This is, I think, germane to the whole tort argument. Mr. Brock says that there have been changes in the tort law which make the liability increasing and perhaps unpredictable. It used to be that we had occurrence insurance. That meant that if we paid the premium, that we were forever after insured so long as the insurance company was still extant. But the insurance company found that they couldn't predict what their losses were going to be. And so, in order to stay profitable, they came up with this wondrous scheme, which I personally think is bad for the people, but I understand why they're doing it. And that is, since they can't predict the risk, they're not going to take the risk. What they're going to do is act as a conduit to the ultimate insurer, and that is whomever is the purchaser of insurance. It's a bit like a drug habit, if you think about it. Once you get hooked, you can't get off very easy. If you pay $10,000 this year, $20,000 next on that escalating cost of 5-year mature rate, now you're looking at 5 years and the insurance company says to you, I'm very sorry, but we've worked hard to control rates, but this year there's a 50% rate increase. You haven't very many choices. You either pay the 50% rate increase, you quit buying insurance. Coincident with the 50% rate increase, they will tell you that the cost of the tail is going to be 1.5 or so, whatever this year's premium is intended to be. And this isn't, I mean, this really happened to people. So the reasoning is, if you can't afford the cost of the insurance that year with the escalated premium,
how in the world can you afford 1.5 times to buy the tail? So you walk away leaving everything on the table. It's true the insurance company keeps all that and they have no further exposure. Now that may be tolerable when we've got a situation like a mutual, a captive or whatever, but when you have a for-profit company, it seems to me to be bad public policy to have that. So I think it isn't so simplistic as saying that if you add 5 years and take the cost of the tail and distribute it over 5 or 10 years, that equals occurrence insurance, because the concept is radically different. Next, the thing about judicial interpretations of law is that they are retrospective. Legislative creations of law are prospective from a date certain. So that if we change the law today, if the legislature, I mean by that, were to change the law today, it has an effective date. And so it is ever after that date that these are the rules by which we interpret what it is that we're going to do with one another. Exactly the opposite is true with a judicial interpretation. You can have a legislative law that's been sitting there for 50 years and it's been the law. When the judicial branch says that it isn't the law anymore, everything that ever happened under that automatically comes under the new law as opposed to them saying, from here on out, this is going to be the way that we're going to deal with it. So, finally, the intent language and whether or not anything that we do here makes any sense, has any impact, and how long do we have to wait for insurance changes? The fact of the matter is that if we did all tort reform that's on the table today, if the legislature passed that into law and the governor signed it into law, there is no way in the world that MICA or any other insurance company could create a rate structure based on those changes in law until they've been appealed to the Supreme Court and held to be law. Because if they make the rates based on these changes or perceived changes, and they get to the Supreme Court 5 years hence, and the Supreme Court says, the rate they pay will be retroactive, not prospective.
If I may, I think the key there, though, is that the rules of the game are most easily applied if the rules that are in place at the time continue to apply. And whether, regardless of how you describe it, and it seems to me that if there are substantive reasons why that should not be done, we should understand those, and if there are not, we should understand that. And that, to me, insofar as a way to reach for those consensus decisions that I think will drive solutions towards final passage, here's an example, in my view, of where insurance reform can resolve the costs of tort problems. Whether or not it technically will end up being called an aspect of tort reform or not, I'm not sophisticated enough on this to say, but clearly it would have a direct effect on the impacts of tort issues and could be a very positive outcome. I think it's so important that we find out whether this is just a profit-making choice, a convenience choice of insurance companies, or whether there's some merit here that's escaped you and me. But it does appear on the surface to be absurd not to be able to buy coverage for what you do when you do it.
Okay. One more comment, and then I'd like to ask Ginger to keep moving this.
Well, I'd like to clarify one thing. It's not quite as simple as Dr. McGuire states in terms of the impact of court opinion. If an opinion is an opinion which creates a new cause of action, then that opinion, that new cause of action, does not have retroactive effect. It takes effect at 12:01 on the particular Friday that it was handed down at Anchorage time. On the other hand, if the opinion interprets a statute, for instance, the court does not make law. The court interprets the statute. If the court finds the statute covers a particular situation, it's not creating new law. It is restating the law that existed from the day that the statute took effect. I mean, it may be slightly academic, but it is a major distinction. And if you look at the body of case law that addresses the retroactivity of civil law, it is a fairly complex subject. And it really seems to me all this stuff about it, the real question is, the reason it's not available for physicians in this state is because we can't find reinsurance to cover it. That's the bottom line. The rest of this discussion is strictly academic. And if we could find some place that would sell reinsurance, then it would be an option that would be available to us.
Okay.
I will go in here. I really suggest, if I can, David, if I can just go through this real quickly,
sure.
And then maybe we can
go
come back because it's going to
go for it. And we need to. We do
okay.
Need some.
By the way, Janet's going to supposedly call. If she calls here, we'll just stop and then make sure we get her questions answered today.
is the statute of repose, if you will, as it applies to medical injury cases. And it's complex. It's based on California law, not identical to California law. It makes some exceptions. What it does is what we have now is an indefinite window under which somebody can bring a claim for medical injury. This narrows that window down on the part of minors to about, I think, 12 years. And it's kind of a complicated thing to think of whether you're over 10 or under 10 or whatever. It has some exceptions. The reason that we deal with minors differently is obviously is because at some point they're too young to tell you where it hurts. At another point, they're too young to bring a case on their own behalf. And sometimes the people that they may be bringing cases against are the people that injured them. Or the people that are responsible for bringing the case for a minor may be a person that they have a case with. Anyway, so this is...
So it distinguishes, it says anybody over 10, if you've got 5 years from the date of injury, and if you're under 10, you've got a little more time.
You've got 5 years or to your 12th birthday, okay. Whichever is the longest.
Okay.
Okay. It also makes some exceptions, obviously, for intentional... fraud, where it's fraud, whether somebody intentionally harms you, and it's also the lost sponge exception. If somebody's left an undiagnosed foreign object in your body, it has no therapeutic purpose.
And those are tolling exceptions?
Those are tolling exceptions. In other words, the time limit doesn't apply in those cases.
Clarification. In fraud, including fraud or collusion by parent, guardian, insurer, or physician, it makes a lot of sense to me that if the doctor or the whomever is covering up something, the healthcare practitioner or the insurance company, I'm a little bit concerned. Collusion by a parent. So does that say that when the individual gets to be 21 years old, they say, well, my parent liked the doctor, and so they collude with the doctor, and so that's thrown out? What exactly does that encompass? I'm not clear.
I am probably the wrong person to ask that to, sir. I think that may be a legal term, and I don't know what collusion means. I mean, I know what I think it means. I don't know what it means under the law.
I don't know if anybody has the answer, but your concern is they might go back and say, well, there was collusion, and then unwind it, and which might not help the rape analysis or solve some of the other problems people are concerned about. Right. Yeah. I don't know if that's ever come up. Again, let's let Ginger get through this, and then we can come back to a couple of comments.
It's basically a technical amendment to make the rest of the Section 5 work.
Okay.
All right. Section 7 has to do with, where it starts in Section 7, we're on page 5, line 3, paragraph B, notwithstanding 0910-140. I think that's the statute that deals with mental incompetence or people who are incarcerated. And so just saying that those people obviously can't be under this other... tolling this period of time, so they have 20 years to bring suit. And if they can't bring suit within 20 years for whatever purpose, I mean, they may not be in a mental state where they can, they may still be incarcerated, and they lose the ability. There's a cutoff at that point for those
okay.
people. Section 8. Well, I'm having Russ, this is from the bill as we originally introduced.
I think I can help you out there. I think that was included just to make it clear that there has to be an inflation adjustment for future payment.
Okay. Section 9 on the bill, basically that was a small thing. There was, in 156 is introduced, it made immune a member of the board of director, an officer, or a nonprofit, or a public corporation. Our committee wasn't sure what that was after, but we didn't think we should be making members of public corporations immune. They're already identified by the state public corporations anyway. Section 10 is a complete repeal and reenactment, and there's hardly anything I've ever seen in committees as complex as this collateral source thing. Section 10, as written in this CS, is based on California collateral source rule and a single rule for all personal injury cases under the committee substitute. Oh, there used to be, under existing law, there's two different collateral source rules. One deals with medical malpractice injuries, and the other deals with all sorts of other personal injuries. This committee substitute makes one collateral source rule that covers all personal injuries. There's no longer a dual system. Section, I have a note here, I'm trying to look at what we deleted. I have trouble. Section 12, in this committee substitute, was Section 18 in the original bill, which tells me that we just dropped a whole lot, and I've got to refer back to the bill to find out what it is that we dropped. Oh, okay. In the original bill that changed the rate of interest on judgment and decrees for payment of money from 10.5% a year to 8%, the committee thought that, it agreed that 10.5% may be too high, that 8% was too low. The problem is that the interest rate is going to go up and down, and if you have it in statute, it's going to probably be unfair.
Yeah, unless you peg it to...
And David and I sat for hours trying to figure out how we could peg this interest rate to the rise in the prime or a percentage of this or that, and we couldn't quite come up with anything, and the Labor and Commerce Committee said, take it out. What else did we leave out?
It looks like you left out the provision that would allow the defendant to request periodic payments for future damages.
Yes, we did. That was an issue that the majority of our committee felt. The standard law says that an injured party can request periodic payments. This would have changed it so that either party could request periodic payments instead of a lump sum settlement. There was a lot of testimony in our committee that this would be a good idea if there were other safeguards in place in the system. That basically attorneys from both sides said that the injured party will always request periodic payments if that's in their financial best interest, in almost every case it is. But because there aren't other safeguards in the system, you should not allow the party who has been found responsible for the malpractice to be able to, it's to their advantage monetarily to pay in periodic payments. It may not be to the advantage of the injured person to get it in periodic payments, and until we can find some kind of system to provide safeguards for the injured party, we just left that alone.
Also looks like you deleted the ban of prejudgment interest on future economic or non-economic damages.
No, I don't think so.
You went with that? Section 11 is in there.
Just
a
clarification.
Sure,
Peter. Did you say that the testimony before the committee said that in most cases periodic payments were viewed as being in the best interest of the plaintiff?
Of the injured party, yeah.
Could you just maybe take about 1 minute to give me an example of that? I'd love to be educated about this, and it always seems to me that if you give me the money that I get to invest it, I can do a lot better than I'm willing to stipulate that someone else can. So what does that mean?
I understand because of tax implications and because of the ability of the average person to invest money on their own behalf, in most cases, for the average person, it would be better for them financially. This is the testimony that we see from both attorneys on both sides. That most of them will accept a periodic payment and prefer a periodic payment if that's in their financial interest.
I'm sorry, I've always heard this to be something of a controversial issue, so I'm a little confused.
The attorneys for injured
periodic payments differ from structured payments? Is it, am I just not?
No, I mean, the concept here says this in simple terms, lump versus stretching it out over time, right? However you want to characterize that. And the issue here is whether the plaintiff can request a structured settlement arrangement or periodic payment plan. So this would allow the defendant to say, that's what I want to do. And that's been taken out.
Do I understand? Yes, because it's
not interesting. Thank you.
I mean, in simple terms, that is the issue.
Thank you. I'll again appreciate your information on that at a later time.
Mr. Chairman, can I make just a point of clarification? The issue at hand, seems to me, is one of future value versus present value. And the argument is, do we as a society say that what we're going to do is return the economic loss at a rate consistent with what the individual would have gained that?
Yes, sir. Forgive me. I understand the philosophy of the arguments. What I didn't ever hear before was that people claiming, desiring payment for damages were at any point suggesting that a periodic payment was in their best interest, and obviously I'm just inadequately informed of that. I know for myself that I'm confident for myself that if you control the interest rate or you control the periodic payment versus giving me the lump sum and letting me invest it, I have a lot of faith in my ability to invest. And so maybe my own experience has colored my view. The thing that I never heard before was the statement that people working for the, I guess you'd say plaintiffs in these cases, concurred with what I believe you're saying, that a periodic payment is better, and I'm going to need some more information on that.
But I don't think they supported the old provision. Janet Johnson's on the phone, I think, so.
Well, I can wait.
And just so you understand, this relates to the portion of damages that relates to future economic damages. That's really the issue here.
I see. Thank you. Well, as I say later, you'll be in debt right now.
Okay.
We got to speak.
We must have a handy dandy.
Do
we have questions?
Is there still somebody who wants to talk to Janet?
No.
Yes. Okay. Hook her up.
Janet, I'm closer to the phone now. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Refresh your memory with the Justice decision, Timothy Justice versus Humana Hospital. I wonder if you could just very briefly run through that decision and the various cost allocations, if you remember them, of that decision. And the purpose of my asking you to do that is so that the committee can see what happens with the same kind of injury under one set of tort rules vis-a-vis what happens under another set of tort rules, never mind the implications of collateral source payments. Could you do that, Jan?
David, I wish I could, but I really can't. I don't have any of the information with me. And it was a pretty complex decision, obviously. I'd be glad to address that in writing, but I can't address it now.
Well, perhaps to the speaker or to others of concern, you could address how that broke out and what the bottom line cost was to each system, California versus Alaska.
I'm sorry, was someone speaking to me?
I'll come back. I sat down because I thought you could hear me. Perhaps you would be willing to address this to the speaker or to any other parties in interest and provide the breakdown of the various cost allocations that were determined by the California system under the current tort laws in California vis-a-vis those that were provided by our tort system. Would you be willing to do that?
I'd be happy to do that. I could do that in writing and address it to the speaker with copies to anyone that wants it.
Thank you.
Other questions for Janet? Bill, you might want to get up.
Yeah, I will. So if anybody wants a copy of that, please see Janet Seitz over here, and we'll immediately mail you a copy as soon as we get it.
Jan, this is Bill Brock.
Yes, sir.
A question was raised this morning concerning Rule 82 and the degree to which, or the experience we may have had with that in the case of defense verdicts. Essentially, the question was, have we ever asked for a Rule 82 determination in our favor? What's been our experience in collecting, if we ever have done so? Can you respond to that?
I think there was a case tried some years ago before I became associated with MICA, where there was an award of costs and attorney's fees, and I think that there was some payment made back to MICA at about $50 a month for a number of months, and that eventually petered out. That's real old history, and it's material that I'm not familiar with. Since I have been there, to the best of my recollection, right off the top of my head, I don't think that we have ever successfully pursued and obtained any monies from plaintiffs who lost in litigation. Most recently, we went through a very difficult trial in Juneau for 3 weeks last summer, and Judge Kraft made an extraordinarily generous award of attorney fees and costs, noting the plaintiff attorney had created a great deal of extra work that didn't need to be created, and that was the basis for the generosity of the award. However, the plaintiffs promptly declared bankruptcy. So I think the highest and best use I could put the piece of paper the judgment is on is probably framing it on my wall. But to the best of my knowledge, we have never been successful in.
Bill, you might ask if your policy is to pursue.
Jan, the question has come up as to whether, as a matter of policy, we would normally pursue that type of a judgment.
Absolutely. My policy in the last 3 years has been to not waive any costs or fees or any judgments that we are awarded in return for an appeal. The only thing that I have waived is our own costs and fees early in litigation if the plaintiff wants to walk away from it. But it has been my policy over the last 3 years not to waive anything. And that policy has been supported very recently, I would say within the last 6 weeks, by our board.
How does that square with what you've told us about your experience in actually collecting anything?
Well, I think we have taken a relatively few number of cases to trial. We're doing that more and more. So if we're talking about collecting judgments that are awarded by the court, we haven't had that many experiences.
addition to the one case that you talked about, two cases where you obtained a judgment for Rule 82 attorney's fees. Can you think of any other cases beyond those two specific cases where you've obtained a judgment for Rule 82?
I guess, Jeff, what I'm thinking about are cases where we have prevailed in a case, for example, on a motion for summary judgment, and we have sought costs and attorney fees. That has happened with some regularity, and I guess that was what I had in my mind, was quite awarded costs and attorney fees in cases that have been dismissed on a motion for summary judgment. And we have been pursuing those doggedly over the last 3 years, and I can't think of one where we have recovered anything. We have one right now that's pending where we've had an offer of $3,000 in payment of a $20,000 judgment that we were awarded, and that we would get that some 6 to 9 months down the road without interest. And if we don't want that, then the plaintiff will declare bankruptcy. I guess that's what I've been thinking about, is the difficulty that we have in collecting any judgment, any award of costs and attorney fees.
Max Gruenberg has a question, Dan.
Yeah,
just coming after that.
No, I'm just
coming to the microphone here.
Okay. Janice, this is Max Gruenberg. I know in some other states, the doctors, and I suspect other defendants in these kinds of cases, have taken the position that when a case is clearly without merit and the attorney has brought the case without any investigation whatsoever, and then the case has been dismissed, often at an early stage, the docs and the former defendants have turned around and sued not only the plaintiff, but the attorney for negligence and vexatious litigation. Are you aware of anything like that having, in an appropriate case, have occurred in Alaska?
No, I don't believe that it has.
Are you familiar with that having occurred elsewhere in the country?
No, I am not familiar with that occurring elsewhere. You read a good deal about it in various journals, and I think it's a concept that a lot of frustrated physicians would like to explore. But I had no first-hand knowledge of it.
But you've read about that having occurred?
Yes.
So why don't you tell us what you've read?
Well, I'm sorry, I can't. You know, I have recollection of having read it, but I can't cite any particular publication or thought from it, other than that it's certainly, I guess I would summarize it, that it's a concept that strikes people who feel that they have been sued by a patient assisted by an attorney with no merit at all and no study of the allegations prior to them being brought, that they have been victimized and that they would like to get some justice out of that. I think that's just kind of common sense summarization of what I think I've read over the years.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Anything else, Jan?
Yes.
Jan, I guess that's it.
Okay.
Before I go on, I just want to briefly, I misspoke the statement of the presentation, I think, of the testimony regarding periodic payments. What the plaintiff attorneys were saying is that when it's in the plaintiff's best interest, they're always going to ask for periodic payments, and therefore there's no reason to make it so that the person who injured them could ask for periodic payments, because the only reason that they would ask for it when the plaintiff didn't want them was because they weren't in the plaintiff's interest. That's what they're trying to say. So they said, make the system so the periodic payments are in the plaintiff's interest and they'll always take it and you don't need to make this change.
Chairman?
Okay.
I can just follow up on Max's question, Janet. And just since we have two plaintiff bar attorneys here, is that a legitimate request from the medical profession? How would you respond, Dan and Jeff? Were injured, in his view, her view, coming to you and saying, will you sue another attorney in my behalf? What would be your response?
First of all, the Alaska court system recognizes a cause of action for vexatious litigation. There are specific standards that the Alaska Supreme Court has set out that you have to satisfy, just like there are standards that you have to satisfy before you can successfully prosecute a malpractice claim. I would think that there are many attorneys who investigated just as if they were investigating any other kind of claim. If they felt that the facts met the standards that the Alaska Supreme Court has set out, that I assume there would be a number of attorneys who would not be reluctant to take that case. I think that if you look back at some of the material that David provided us, we were talking about it yesterday, it's not necessarily a legal malpractice case, but if we have any experience concerning the willingness of the Alaska Bar to sue other lawyers, we see that the number of legal malpractice cases over the last 3 years, I think in the breakdown from the court system, approached the number of medical malpractice cases, perhaps 66%, a ratio of 66% to 100%, something like that. So I guess, in short, given what I know personally, my own personal evidence, what I can see from this information, I doubt there would be reluctance on the part of a number of competent, aggressive attorneys to take that case if they thought the case was there.
Could I respond to Russ's question, too, with just one quick footnote? You know, many people who are involved in litigation, who are the prevailing party or a case which is successfully defended, feel as though the litigation was vexatious and that they were victimized by litigation. And the fact is that to defend a case and to lose a case does not put you in the posture to bring an action for vexatious litigation. I mean, it really is something more than that, because the court system, the whole civil justice system, recognizes that there are legitimate controversies. I mean, there are things that are looked at by two different ways, and sometimes when that can't be resolved, you go before 12 people off the street and they make a decision. So, yes, lawyers will certainly look and take those cases, but it is, it is the groundless bad faith type of a case which is the proper basis of that cause of action, and not simply a case where someone brings an action and loses the action because the jury decides to weigh the evidence in favor of the defendant and not in favor of the plaintiff.
David.
Two very quick points. The first, to respond to that, the words are carefully chosen. If you can prove that they violated the standards set by the Supreme Court, and there is a requirement to prove special damages. They're not ordinary damages, so you must prove that you've been damaged in some way down the road. I've been challenged on this before, Roger Holmes amongst others, and subsequently his research has confirmed that. I'd be happy if anybody challenges me again on that concept to see the statute. But basically, what that amounts to saying is that to sue an attorney successfully for vexatious suits or whatever you want to say is practically impossible because of the requirements of the standard proof that you've got to do special damages. The other point I want to go back to and relate to is now we heard that plaintiffs don't do bankruptcy, and now we heard from Jan Johnson that we do. We've heard from Micah that they try to collect the money, and we've heard that they don't get the money. We've heard other people say that the panels aren't working, and if they aren't working, we ought to do something about it. And I submit to you that Rule 82 is in no different position, at least as regards medical mal, and that is, if its intent is not working, then it should be legitimate to do something about it.
Matt.
A couple of things. First of all, I didn't hear anybody saying that plaintiffs don't declare bankruptcy, because they certainly do.
Mr. Chair,
I
don't
know. Yeah.
No, I mean, David, I think is making some gross generalizations here. Go ahead.
The second thing is, I'm not aware of a statute that requires the proof of special damages in a case of that type. But we're here in the legislative capacity, and if there is, we can certainly take a look at it. I know, flat out, that having that potentiality out there can be used really to make somebody who is thinking of bringing a professional action against any kind of a professional look twice at his facts. I have had it done to me, and I have used it. And it really makes the person think twice before bringing the suit. We're not talking about here an impossible burden or anything. We're just saying, hey, before you go down and pursue this, and even if you happen to have filed it, listen to our side of the story and really check it out, because if you bring it and then we put you on notice that you have no basis for this, then you as well as your client are on notice. And I think that's a very fair thing to do, because it can be so damaging to a professional's reputation. It's the same thing you were talking about on House Bill 146. Just the mere making of a claim can have a real effect.
One other thing I think is important in this very area is that there's also Civil Rule 11, which requires that any allegation contained within a complaint be made with a factual basis following reasonable inquiry. Now, the federal courts in recent years have really started utilizing Rule 11 and going after lawyers who have filed cases without taking the time to investigate and establish a factual basis for that. So, and that's also the basis of not only court-imposed sanctions, but disciplinary action as well.
Just on that point, a couple of months ago, the Supremes amended Rule 11 to delete part of the provisions that had some teeth in. I was concerned when I saw that. I think that was in the January rules that came out. And I think we ought to take a look, because Rule 11 can really be used in some senses in this. It's been misused in the lower 48, but I think that may be something to look at. I think they may have gone too far to rely on Rule 95.
It's an interesting historic footnote. You know, I don't think very many people take bankruptcy, and we didn't hear Janet Johnson talk about people taking bankruptcy. We heard her talk about an individual, and I don't know if that's a widespread practice or not. However, I do know that an Anchorage jury in the last 4 months entered an award of $1.5 million against a lawyer for advising the lawyer to have his client take bankruptcy as an attempt to escape the exposure for the claim.
That was a failure.
That's right. Well, he tried to take him into bankruptcy and advised him too on facts in which he couldn't get a $6.5 million verdict by a jury. Ginger, yeah.
Okay, before I finish out what is in Labor Commerce CS-166, there's a couple of things we took out of the bill as it came to us that we should go over. There was a change in the original bill, Section 5, page 3, that dealt with made it cover to collect punitive damage. The Labor and Commerce Committee recognized that punitive damages are not covered by insurance, therefore making it tougher to collect punitive damage is not going to have any effect on insurance rates, and therefore we just took it out.
To the other side of that story was that language to retract a case law on the subject. So, the punitive damage thing.
Then further on that, the committee also recognized that punitive damages do have a detrimental effect on, you know, making people behave better. I mean, if they know that they're faced with potential punitive damage, they're less likely to do wrong. And we thought that removing the chance of punitive damages are rarely awarded in Alaska. They don't have anything to do with insurance rates. They may have an impact of reducing the disincentive to do wrong. We just didn't want to mess with it.
Did we change the standard for punitive damage?
86. Yes. We jacked it up in 86. Clear and convincing, Benson. And then this language is supposed to just reflect current.
This language would make it clear, convincing, and intentional. There was
moving right along.
There was a fairly lengthy section in the original bill as filed, Section 6. In Section 6 and 7 of the bill as filed, current law says that if you're involved in a felony and you're injured, and the felony you were involved in substantially contributed to your injury, you can't sue. This section would have changed felony to a crime. We hassled it. And the fact is that no such case has ever been brought in Alaska, nor is it ever likely to be, and nor is any jury ever likely to award damages when somebody was involved in a crime that contributed to their injuries, and we thought that it was a moot point and took it out. Section 9 of the bill is followed. We left, change federal benefits, change the interest rate. We talked about that. Section 14 of the bill is filed. It was a lengthy section that simply had a section that made it comport with Section 15 of the bill, which dealt with an amount awarded by the court or jury for non-pecuniary damages may not exceed $50,000. We went round and round about this because the way that it was written in the bill was not the intent of the sponsor. The impact of the way it was written was not anybody's intent. We went in and out of it and decided it was too complex and didn't know how to deal with it. We took it out. It specifically, what it was aimed at is the state of people who die without the
As I recall, it's been a while since I thought about this, but yeah, it was designed or intended. I think the original folks intended this to only cover situations where there are no
dependents and no children.
And in that case, it was perceived as a windfall and a waste of money.
Okay. Section 16 of the bill is filed, costs allowed for prevailing parties. I'm not the attorney here, but I'm looking at it, and it seems to me that this would have amended Civil Rule 82 and to delete the section that allows the award of attorney's fees when civil action has been contested.
I think that's right.
Okay. We also deleted the Jackson Power provision from 166, which was the several lengthy sections that dealt with the liability of hospitals.
By the way, while I'm thinking of that, David Crosby made a presentation last time on the subject, and Ames Luce wanted a chance to respond. He has provided us with some briefing on the matter.
He did respond at the last meeting.
Yeah, Yeah, but he's also provided us with some briefing on the matter, which we left out in the other room if anybody's interested.
Okay, the Labor and Commerce Committee dealt with the Jackson Powers situation in a lengthy bill that we handled in 1988. The decision of the committee at that time was to not expand the immunity for hospitals in that case. We dealt with it, talked a lot about it in 166 when it came before us and deleted the section. The only further changes in 166 through the committee substitute is that we added some provisions in the part of the bill that deals with director's annual report, basically an analysis of liability insurance claims, closed claims analysis, and some other information. The committee substitute added a repealer, they added a repealer in section 13, page 8, the first repealer, and what that was is, remember, there were two different ways to figure collateral sources, you know, one for medical injury, one for everything else, and we eliminated the two
they
different
just
ways.
Set up one system. Okay.
In the bill as filed, trying to find the...
Page 6.
Okay, the bill as filed, page 10, section 20, there was a repealer that we deleted and the committee substituted. Right now there's a cap on non-economic damages, exception cases, and gross disfigurement, and the bill as filed would have applied that cap to those cases also.
Would have repealed the disfigurement exception.
Exception. We repealed the repealer, and so it stays the same as it is in current law. The only other changes, we did a couple of... We were really wrestling, and this is the end of it, so I'll try to get out of here. We had a problem because after the 166 was filed, we had the oil spill. And this problem was one of the things I think that sparked the speaker from being accused of pimping for the oil industry, which is very interesting. And the problem deals with, and I wish there were more attorneys here, deals with the case in the question we're dealing with is that when we asked the Attorney General, we said, is anything, the problem we're dealing with is that 166 said, the applicability and effective date said it applies to anything where the injury has accrued on or before the effective date of the act. Persons, I understood, and I'm not the attorney here, so my understanding is in the Prince William Sound oil spill case, there was an argument that it is what they call a continuing tort. In other words, the damage had not accrued. So if the bill became effective with the language that was in it, it could mean that the statute of repose, for instance, if it passed as it was originally introduced, a six-year statute of repose, could have been read to apply to damages from the oil spill, even though the actual spill occurred after the bill became law. It was an ongoing tort. It was an ongoing injury, so the total damage hadn't accrued. So we messed around with the Attorney General wrote us back and said, officially, we can give you no response in writing because we obviously anticipate litigation and we can't put anything in writing. Unofficially, we agreed that you need to play around with the applicability and the effective date to try to address it because it was clearly that the sponsor and everybody did not intend this bill retroactively apply to an injury that had already occurred. And so the committee is not convinced that what we did here really sufficiently addresses that problem. We're not sure it can be addressed, and we can't get much help from the AG's office because they can't give us any kind of official language in the face of litigation. So that's it.
Yeah.
Why did the committee think it would be fair to impose such a law on unidentified future victims and not impose it on the victims of the oil spill? Is it strictly a political question? I mean, if it's fair, it's fair. If it's fair, why are we hesitating to apply it on past victims as well as future victims? Where's your hand? I mean, did they...
I'm sorry, I don't have a right to stop being...
That's exactly right, Jim. And I think that's the point of it. I think that if something is fair and should become a component of the civil justice system, it should be applied with no reservation. And to suggest that we'll apply it in the future because to apply it now might cause problems with certain people who already see themselves as victims and makes it politically unacceptable. I mean, I think that really goes to the question of the merits of the recommendation.
Anything else on HB 166?
Yeah, I have one major comment on page 6.
The page 6 of what? The CS? Or
CS, the CS, okay. Collateral benefits. Now, is this the current act?
This is the current
act. Yes, this is the current act. This is the current act.
What I would, I mean, here's the problem with the collateral.
The California system.
No.
Well, it's based on the California system.
Go ahead.
What this statute allows, as proposed, is it allows the wrongdoer to lengthen significantly the time to trial by imposing whole new issues that before are already decided by the judge afterward as opposed to the jury. And it also allows the wrongdoer to effectively bar the subrogation claim of innocent subrogee interests who might very well have a right to collect it. For instance, I'm injured in an auto accident, my Blue Cross carrier pays $100,000 for my injury. I bring an action against the driver of the other vehicle. The way it's written now, at the election of the defendant, the wrongdoer, by simply introducing the fact that I have received $100,000 from my Blue Cross carrier, not only can I not make that claim, but Blue Cross, who has a subrogation claim, who figures its rates, by the way, on recovering back so much of this money, no longer has a right to collect that money back. As the system works right now, this evidence would not come before the jury, and after the case is over, the judge would hear that information and would order that portion of the judgment paid back to Blue Cross. It's already covered in the law, but we've somehow made this part of, I mean, it has absolutely to do nothing with the issues that the jury has to decide, and it allows the wrongdoer to randomly deny the rights of subrogee interest. So if you have an aunt who's injured and you loan her $10,000 so she can get her operation, by the simple fact that you've loaned her the money and paid her medical bills is introduced to trial, not only can she not collect the $100,000 to pay you the money back, but you can't collect the $100,000 back. And when I saw this down here last week, I called the state of Alaska, Health and Social Services, and I have seen it, although I don't have it with me, but it's been developed now, and I can have it produced to the chair. The state of Alaska, this will cost the state of Alaska approximately $1 million a year, because right now the state last year, for instance, collected $970,000 back, subrogation for health benefits it provided, which in turn was paid back when litigation was concluded. This bill would effectively deny the state the right to collect that money back. And there's no reason why, there's no reason why the wrongdoer. The point here is we don't want double recovery. The amendment has already been made, the change in the law is already there. There is no double recovery. The judge sees that there's no double recovery. If there's subrogation, the subrogee is entitled to be paid back. Earlier someone said something about good faith. I mean, if there's anything we've talked about today, I mean, someone who is far more cynical than I could look at this and say this is an attempt to confuse the jury, to try and make the jury think that the plaintiff is trying to double recover. And I don't think it serves any purpose. It doesn't do anything. The law already doesn't do it. It just does it a lot less efficiently and cuts off the subrogation rights of legitimate people who have the right to recover back money they've expended.
The problem is that what should work in theory doesn't work in fact. Even with the collateral source law that we have relative to the medical mal, what the judge did in that instance was reduce the present value and offset. Next, the goal of this legislation is to prevent double recovery. It seems to me that the purpose of the language that is written here is to prevent the plaintiff, victim, from having the collateral source offset and then having someone come back subrogate after that. Now, I don't think that any of us have a problem that including the damages in there one time and having them go through to a subrogation, that's fine. But what you don't want to have is a situation where you offset the collateral source by law and then allow someone to subrogate against the plaintiff who's already had that offset. That's what the intent is, okay? Next. I understand that the state of Alaska has gotten some money in subrogation and all that sort of thing. I don't know what the cost of recovering the money that they get may be. And what does happen is that there's significant litigation after the case relative to subrogation. Now, to the extent that we streamline the system and reduce that cost, it seems to be cost effective. The intent was never to have the collateral source offset and then to have the patient be, or the victim be subrogated by someone else. And if it says that, then we need to work on the language, because that's certainly not the intent.
That's what it does say.
I'm not sure of that, but we can work on that. As long as we understand the intent.
Can I address facts and fiction? This is the second time that Dr. McGuire has referred to a particular court case as an example as to why the collateral source rule on the books now doesn't work. If we're going to speak anecdotally, let me say that every case that I've handled since the collateral source rule has been on the books has been, the judges applied it just like the statute was meant to apply. Money was deducted from my client's recovery and paid back to the appropriate people, and no windfall has ever come to my client as a result of the collateral source. Now, if there are facts in that case which should suggest that we should repeal the collateral source statute on the book, let the doctor come forward with and let's look and let's see if the judge really applied the law like he was supposed to or not. But let's proceed on anecdotal information. Second of all, I believe the statement was there's significant litigation over subrogation interest after personal injury cases. But since we're speaking anecdotally again, what happens in my cases is that after we finish, I get on the phone to the representative of the state of Alaska. I tell him how much I recover. He tells me how much his lien is. I write him a check. I have never had any litigation with the state of Alaska on their Medicare recovery plan. I don't have litigation with Aetna, Blue Cross, any of the other insurers who have subrogated rights for their insureds and who know that when I have a case, I suppose the greatest expense is they call me up once a month to find out when my case is going to settle so they can get paid. It works very efficiently. And as I mentioned yesterday, the collateral source rule has been identified, the collateral source rule that we have in the state has been identified as one of the most effective pieces of civil justice litigation, civil justice reform legislation, in terms of reducing claims frequency and severity. We have a model on the books at this point. I don't see any arguments that suggest that it isn't working. I don't think it's fair to use anecdotes that we can't support to suggest that it is working.
Period.
There's a real claims handling nightmare ahead of whoever passes the bill like this. There's already a tendency for casualty insurance carriers to refer medical bills to health carriers and to avoid responsibility, etc. There's two reasons for that. One, of course, is to save that money. But the second thing is that when pain and suffering settlements are made, they're often made on the basis of the medical expense. And insurance carriers are trying to get the medical expense pared down that way so that they won't have to pay the proper amount of money for the claim to start with. It's a very subtle thing. It has very significant change implications to people who are the victims of accidents. The basic problem being that in the claims transaction, the standard of recovery should be the verdict value. And the elements of verdict value, of course, are general, special, and punitive damages.